Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal form, the born of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horde, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good wherever, whenever. This is Alan Averill, and this is Agitators Anonymous podcast, episode 23. And this is a special podcast. It's also available as a video cast over on my YouTube channel. If you want to take a look at my ugly mug and my esteemed guest, who is Matt McInerney, or Kvost, from Grave Pleasures, Hex Vessel, Beast Milk, Dodheim's Guard, Code, among many others. It was a great and very interesting chat. Matt is a very thoughtful and intelligent guy. He's not a man who seeks out the limelight. And so it was somewhat unusual. And we discuss the music industry, we discuss the state of the world right now. And he always has a slightly sideways glance at it. So that's what it's going to be, episode 23. So go to nthianga_primordial, follow me on Instagram, patreon.com, Alan Averill with two capital A's. AVERILLL, and I post other content, bonus podcasts, demos, this and that over there. And as I said last week, if you were listening, we now have a sponsor on the program, and that is Hate Couture, which is, how should we say, what can we call it? Hateful yet tasteful clothing company. And that is at www.hate.com. As in H-A-T-E, you know how to spell that, right? C-O-U-T-U-R-E 616.com. All sorts of hateful yet tasteful t-shirts. I'm looking at Vlad Tepes board shorts. There's a summer sale on. Charlie Manson hats. A few nasty Ed Gein t-shirts. Black Death t-shirts. As in the original virus. The original Black Death. You need some satanic bling, some awful apparel. You know you do. You know you do. Go and check it out anyway. www.hatecouture616.com. Or follow me on Instagram and you'll see a few photos popping up now and again. All those kind of things. So, without further ado, let's have a listen to Matt. Episode 23, Agitators Anonymous. Here we go with Matt McInerney.
All right. How are you, sir? What's going on?
I'm good. I don't know, a lot of stuff, trying to figure out how to live with two kids. And we got a new house, so we're in the middle of a renovation extravaganza.
All right.
The fun never stops, basically.
Are you having to do like homeschooling stuff?
No. Luckily, they're just they're in daycare. They're just, our son's only 5 and daughter's 1.5, so no need to do any homeschooling. The daycare was off for a while, but it hasn't been that bad in Finland, you know.
No, a lot of my friends here have said that at the beginning of this, well, I suppose we might as well start talking about all this stuff.
Yeah, why not?
They said that then one of the most difficult things was that for the first month or two, especially here when the weather was okay, it was a little bit of like, oh, this is a kind of a small little summer holiday. That might be the wrong expression, but especially like Kieran from Primordial was saying, he enjoyed the first few months with his kids, but then it started to get like, oh, now we have to homeschool and work because all the schools were closed. And now our government is busy wrangling over, well, what, the school's opening, not opening. And it just seems to me that that's an incredibly strenuous task to have to try and undertake as well, as, you know, like homeschooling.
Yeah, we made a really smart decision a couple of years ago to move to a really cheap place, very small, and just live very, very cheaply. So we don't have to worry about the outgoings a lot, which was just, you know, like a shrewd move anyway. But considering what's happened, it kind of saved us because we didn't have a huge rent, a huge mortgage or anything like that. So we kind of made it through, but it's been a really tough year. It's like, like you said, trying to work and do this kind of like bringing up kids at the same time and do music as well. It's just been and I think just the mindset, you get into that kind of doom and gloom mindset, basically. So I think it's been a struggle.
It's hard when there's no sort of like line to, like if somebody said to me, okay, in 6 months' time, you work towards that. There's the moment where you're sort of let out of the pen or whatever you want to say, let out of penury or whatever. But without that sort of line to work towards, it's kind of a little bit hard to stay motivated.
Yeah, I think we've been lucky in Finland. There hasn't been a huge lockdown. It didn't last that long. And we were given a bit of an earlier reprieve than most places. And at the moment, the numbers are keeping low. So I don't think it's really half as much as other places. And living in Tampere as well is like small city. The numbers were really low. I think we've done all right up here. So it's just, you know, small struggles like everyone else, but I can't really complain. Kind of feel bad complaining, actually, because you read about people having real hardships and things are going down in America and UK and everything. It's just, we're kind of lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I try to say that to people here in Ireland, because obviously we're kind of stuck, I suppose, culturally between United Kingdom and the USA on either side. And I suppose we've always sort of looked to either of those countries. But when it comes to something like this, the lockdown or whatever, I do try and say to people like, hey, you know, like geographically, maybe try and look at some other countries in Europe, but also try and look at the size of populations from other countries, because people in Ireland are, I think there's a form of sort of catastrophizing that goes on, you know, and they sort of go, oh, but look what's happened in America. And they go, yeah, but we live in Ireland. Maybe you should think about other countries in Eastern Europe that have 4 or 5 million people that live in it, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just a phenomenon of the global civilization that we live in, that people are just importing other people's problems and thinking that they live in them. So, you know, we were talking about this with a friend of mine the other day, that we live in America now, you know. We live in Europe, but we're in America because we're in the American mindset, and it so dominates the news and our culture that we believe that America's problems are our own. And I mean, you know, I feel for the people of America, but we don't live there, so we have to be, you know, to be mindful of how things are, but I just don't think people really read the news. They don't really pay attention to what's going on. So most people, when you discuss what's going on in Finland, they'll tell you about what's going on in America, and they don't really know that the numbers are pretty low in Finland, that you're going to get hit by a bus sooner than you're going to get COVID-19. So they just
don't know that. And following whatever's going on in America, I think just feels cooler. You know, you feel more alive, whereas actually it's pretty boring. There's not really much going on here. We're not in danger of a widespread outbreak. So yeah, just like I said, it's just like, I feel kind of like I have to think about the positives and I focus on positives. You kind of have to do when you've got kids. You can't dwell in a, you know, even if you've grown up listening to metal and you like sad music, you can't really live that in your day-to-day life. You have to remain positive about what's going on. And there's a bright future out there somewhere.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought about that. I suppose it makes sense because not having kids, maybe I've got more time to be prone to sort of fatalism and catastrophizing. And whereas maybe that's something to do with, you know, people in the West not having that many kids, that they're this obsessed with some of the, you know, sort of negative forces, maybe more so that's happening. Like you're totally right. We import whatever's happening in the American news. I mean, people come out in the streets to protest things that happen in America, you know, but don't seem really to me that worried about handing over some of their freedoms to the Irish state. It doesn't really seem to bother them that much, you know?
Yeah. And then if you just look at the way that we organize our, you know, everything culturally, music scene is very American focused in Europe. And, you know, people are complaining about not being able to travel, but it's like, what about your own music scene? What about your home music scene? Why have you been neglecting it for so long? There's all these small clubs that you could go and support. And people just, you know, don't think locally. They've been thinking so globally for so long that it's also part of the problem. You know, it's like, if your clubs are closing down, maybe it's because you haven't been in like years.
And these clubs,
we got to face it, like they've been doing badly for a really long time. It's not like COVID-19 really killed all the clubs. They've been dying slowly anyway. So this is kind of like a final nail in the coffin. But I think it's just sort of everything you do in life, it came to light during this year, kind of how I'm also guilty of it as well, that of not really thinking in terms of where am I getting this produce, where am I buying these clothes, what am I supporting? Am I supporting local producers, or am I sending my money to China? You know, and nothing against the Chinese. It's just I think when it comes to crisis like this, the only way you get through it is by sort of you know, supporting your local businesses and charity starting at home, basically.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, here we haven't even got the opportunity for even just an acoustic guitar in the corner of a pub. I mean, even at the moment, we can't have those gigs. Like, so the clubs that are here that still theoretically would play or would allow live bands, they aren't able to do anything. And I've seen, you know, footage of open air theater and comedy. And it's quite strange here. It's as if the state is sort of is allowing it to die on the vine, but also there just seems to be little invention. I'm probably going to get loads of comments now about this going, oh, there was a, you know, but I haven't seen anything. I haven't heard of any band trying to do anything. All of the clubs are closed. So I don't even know how. I don't think even Primordial could do a spaced and distanced show right now in Ireland. I don't think we could do that. You know, that is that allowed? Are you allowed to do things like that in Finland? I mean, I saw last weekend lots of shows in Europe were starting to happen. Cult of Fire played to no distance in Prague, for example. You know.
Yeah, there are shows happening, local small shows. We've got one in a couple of weeks, but it's sort of, it'll be limited to 100, 200 people max. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger shows just aren't happening. The festivals are all cancelled. And it's just about organisation and the cost of the organisation. So, it's the security, it's making sure everybody's safe and distance and all that stuff, that I guess the costs of running these things are already really extortionate. So you start to add all those other things in there, and it just, for local festival organizers, it becomes impossible. But there are small clubs happening. It's just more like maybe these places would have been in a better state had there been more interest in the live scene before this happened. You know, it's been dying anyway. A lot of that, I think, is to do with the bigger bands. I mean, it's a bigger topic, maybe not a very interesting thing for me to talk about because I don't know about it. I dwell in the underground, but the bigger bands sucking the money out of the market and just making it more difficult for anybody else to compete, and generally audiences dwindling. So it's been kind of coming for a while, and this thing has just it's kind of put the nail in the coffin for a lot of bands that, you know, at our level, when you go out and play small gigs, you're not going to be able to tour or get things done very easily. So
I think there's kind of like, there's going to be an economy for bands who pull 50 to 100, 120 people playing in 400, 500, 600 venues. But for bands pulling, let's say 300 to 800, I suppose the medium big bands, I suppose by today's standards, big-ish bands, that means at a 20% cap, they're having to play in 3, 4, 5,000 places, which they don't really exist. And the economy doesn't really exist to put us there or to travel between them. So I have a weird feeling that the next months of next year are going to see, or at the end of this year are going to see, like small little underground shows and then huge bands doing like residencies. Like, I don't know, Def Leppard plays 10 days at Def Leppard. The modern reference. Think of something modern that isn't from 1986. And they're going to do like a week or 10 days where they have the gear set up and people are going to pay 120, 250 euros a ticket. And those two things can survive, I think. But the middle bit where we often inhabit could be very difficult.
Yeah, I think so. That market has also been really difficult for a while anyway. A lot of the clubs of that size have been closing. So there's just been this struggle with a band. And you know how this is. It's like a band that's doing well to jump to the next level. The jump is just so massive. And as an audience member as well, it's really difficult because I don't want to go and see a band that I love playing an ice hall. You know, I know it's like there's this thing that one Finnish, famous Finnish musician said, it's just like that music doesn't belong there, you know, in ice halls and stuff like that. And that's kind of the situation we've got here, is that in Helsinki, it's kind of like, you know, big venue or ice hall, you've got nothing in between. And there's no charm to enjoying music in that environment. But I think maybe it will make people appreciate music more. I hope so. I focus on that like the hunger for getting out and seeing live music when this all kind of goes back to normal will be a case of just people getting really hungry for it. There'll be a big market for small bands. And I saw that Fender have made like more guitars this year than any other year in their history or something. So it's like people are buying guitars like crazy, because they're learning guitar. So maybe there's going to be a big renaissance of all these bedroom, guitarists when they come out of lockdown.
That's interesting.
People making music. I don't know if it's going to result in them actually making albums, but it would be great. I mean, it would be great if there's like time for people to do stuff. There'll be a lot of talent there that was, you know, in the 9 to 5 who had time to do some music while he was locked down it comes out, or there's like a new punk movement or something that's just born out of frustration of not being able to gather with your friends or something.
And that's interesting. I'd have to I'd have to digest that. But the kind of immediate worry I would, well, not worry, but the immediate sense I would have when thinking about that is that it could be a movement indeed, but it might just be a movement of people just releasing more music online. It might not be a actual human process. And like I sort of said this to, I've been saying it sort of flippantly, I suppose in a grumpy way, as is my wont for the last while, that like, look, if there's no travel, no human process, no agency, I'll do one more metal album. But I mean, if it was to just stay like this, I wouldn't make any more heavy metal. I wouldn't see the point, because it's about, you know, you're basically going, hey, okay, now you're just this square on the screen. There's no more rock and roll. And I don't mean rock and roll as in just sex, drugs and rock and roll, just the agency of purpose. And this new normal of being just a square on a screen, I think I'd rather sort of think to myself, okay, you had a good run of, well, 29 years. So maybe, you know, hang your hat on one last album and that's it. No, I think that's catastrophizing. I don't think that's actually probably going to happen, but some element of it might happen, and therefore maybe what you're talking about is like you will get this movement of people online who'll go, okay, this is the new normal, and we just will just play streams or whatever, or I don't know.
So yeah, I get. It
was just a ramble. Yeah,
yeah, but I totally get you. I mean, there are so many forms of music that are just based on live, the live experience, and so does that become? I've been asking this question. It keeps me up actually thinking about does this music have a relevance or a place outside of that, or does it just become this kind of like quaint kind of bygone memory of you know, like 1930s Lindy Hop or something like that, you know, we just think of it as, oh, that was nice, that's sweet, but it's not like we that happens anymore, because gathering makes you sick, you know. Does it enter a sort of mindset where we change the way we do things permanently forever, because, you know, they say this is not the only virus out there, and so yeah, it's a question, is this a generational thing or not? But I try to think about the positives. I work for Svart Records now since last year, and that's really helped me in not doing so much live music. So the income of that has gone down, but I keep working, and I keep working within music, and the sales have been really good, and the interest in product is still really strong. Whether that continues, we just have to wait and see. But for a label like that, there's still a big market out there. I guess there's been a lot of people at home wanting to listen to music, wanting the real thing, you know, the product and everything. So it's still there. Maybe it's just become more direct. People want things directly from the the artists and from smaller labels. I guess the bigger labels might be struggling when they come to looking at bands that they've been relying on to be their biggest stockist, you know. So labels that have relied on just their original artists, that might be a problem. So Svart Records is dealing with a lot of reissues of old albums and things like that. So you've got the vinyl collector market, but the original artist labels who rely on the touring band, that might be a bit of trouble, you know.
I think anecdotally, what I heard was that when this all started, you're relying on, I guess, moving 500 to 1,000 to 2,000 of physical products to collectors. But for, I suppose, more mainstream or bigger labels who are relying on the streaming revenue, I think when this all started, streaming just went boof, like took a big drop. Because even if you think about it, people are having to change their listening habits because they're no longer commuting, working with headphones in. They haven't got the space and time to listen to music has changed. And anecdotally, they just sort of said, our streams have just dropped a lot. And so if you're not kind of physical product moving, I guess they had to reinvent themselves with different things in the merch store, I suppose, and that kind of stuff. But it definitely stranded, I mean, it was more noticeable ever than it stranded artists. Because all of a sudden, with no live, we had no income, you know. There's, you know, because there obviously isn't any money for an artist from streaming, you know. I mean, you have to stream like at least 500 to a million times a month for one person is know yourself to make a poor McDonald's style living. So that's interesting you said that about Svart is like as a sort of a kind of, they have their niche carved out, you know.
Yeah, that works. So, I mean, maybe that's just sort of the secret to all of this. It's like just finding your niche and, you know, making that work, focusing on the bits that work like that. But yeah, if your whole being and existence is based on playing live, that must be in such disarray. I was looking at what Nick Cave said, you know, he was like, he was looking at all the artists who are doing sort of lockdown sessions and stuff like that. And he just said, look, you know, don't make your art about this. Just have the time, take the time to go and see your family, you know, be creative, and all of that. And I thought that was a really romantic kind of notion. And I really agreed, because it resonates with me, who I think always kind of had a little bit more of the time, because I'm not touring 24/7. So I was a bit more torn between you know, is this really worth it? I'm spending a bit of time on the road away from family. It's not really actually doing that much good at the moment for my music career. I could still release music, play some shows, and spend more time with them. So it really, it was really like this is the truth. But then I thought, for a lot of bands that are touring all the time and that's their life, that must have been kind of, maybe it's insulting, you know. And it's like, what are we going to do? Like, we're not going to work, you know. Where's our revenue? How are we going to pay the bills, for example, you know?
I mean, initially, like, for example, for myself, my income went from being okay to literally nothing within 2 weeks. Everything, of course, unfortunately, just as it turns out, you put all your eggs in the industry basket, whether it's working for the industry or playing live. But you adapt and cope. And, you know, I'm a heavy metal cockroach. I'll figure that out. But then I began to go, oh, okay, this is my superpower is gone. My agency is gone, my purpose, my motivation, all these kind of things. And then I just thought, I have no interest in playing a live show to an empty room and putting all the stuff on and then forget it. Maybe one intimately filmed rehearsal where we can discuss the songs, I would bend to that. But everything else, I just sort of said, no, I'm not going to take part in those kind of things. But I'm at the stage now where I would go out and tour for nothing, for no money. Which I do with Dread Sovereign anyway. But because it's agency and purpose, which I suppose is the difference between a person with no family maybe and yourself with family. There's that kind of acute difference. But yeah, it's true. It's first you had the financial worry. And then you realize, oh, okay, I'm just living on the same bunch of streets, and that's going to start to drive me absolutely nuts. So there is that sense of, like, it's a kind of buzzword of this year, but I keep using it, agency. I kind of like it, agency and purpose, you know?
But it's true, and this is the sort of dry question of the artist is sort of your purpose, your drive, you know, what this all means. These are the questions that you ask yourself all the time. It's a constant dialogue, I think, with yourself. And so now you're faced with it, kind of like straight in your face. You know, this is like an urgent question of like, how do I remain kind of relevant to myself and to the drive that I have as being creative. And I think that's sort of why I can understand the outrage at the moment is it's this industry where people just they think it's totally unimportant, and the music business has been for a long time kind of marginalized and put down as a really irrelevant art form. You know, you sort of like, oh, you should be lucky, you're so lucky. I don't know how many people tell me, oh, you're so lucky to do that stuff, and it's like they don't understand the sacrifice, you know, the daily sacrifice of an artist who you just cannot, I mean, you know, talk about that with the family thing. It's like it just adds another layer of pain into the equation of having to, like, well, you know, I really can't play with my son right now because I have to get this thing done. And the question of, is this really important, or, you know, who's it important to?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you want your art to outlive you and to have some relevance and importance. And if you do things with a passion, as I know, like, you know, that's the thing with it. We're talking about Primordial playing live because it's such passionate music and you do things with so much heart that I can understand the idea that you don't want to put on a, you know, just a show to an empty room, because it's about the connection with your audience and all of that. So it's sort of the same thing with the art. It's without that possibility to connect, you really start to question who you are. Is this worth spending time away from family? You know, there's enough art out there, and I think it's just really sad because it should be more supported. And there were a lot of funds going around, and I just think they were misappropriated, misplaced, not used in the right way. You reading it all, and you can't help it. You're as an artist, you look at who gets the money. You know,
oh, yeah, they wouldn't so do that see, here.
Like,
they
I applied for a few, I didn't get it, but obviously I don't have a Finnish surname. I understand they probably just want to give it to Finnish people. It's fine. But I read, you know, you read who gets it, and it's like these people aren't living on, they're not living doing music. There's nothing culturally important about what they're doing, but they're getting funding. And it's just like, it just became a bit of a farce. Yeah. And I just think how people relate to musicians and all of these things for a long time, it's been fucked. And now it's even worse because, people are like, why should we care about these guys? You know, they were lucky. They had fun on the road. You know, they should be, be thankful.
That's exactly right. And that's kind of some of the vibe I get from, some of the comments and vibe I get is just like, they're basically, to be relevant now, there are people are saying to me, well, you're going to have to be a content creator. But like a content creator with there's no income to it attached to it. You have to sort of try and whip up second, third, fourth party sort of interest in it. I mean, this is something that I can enjoy talking to people and the podcast and stuff, but I'm not going to sit and play an acoustic guitar in the room, you know, doing computer game covers and go, you know, but that's basically what people are saying into some of the bigger labels is like, hey, look, do game? Because that's going to be your living now. You're going to be gaming on Twitch, I'm 45 years old. Why didn't you ask me this when I was playing FIFA 98 or something, you know?
I mean, you're known for a good conversation and for an intelligent one, and I think that's something in the scene that you're known for, and it goes together with your music. So I can totally see this format as really suiting you, as not being sort of relegated to just a quarantine thing or a COVID-19 thing. Yeah. It really worked for what you are as an artist. But I mean, I'm not really, I don't think I'm an interview person. I think when it comes to my art, it speaks much more interestingly than I can come across. And it's always, I wear my music pretty much on my sleeve. It's there in the music, the message is there. So I don't really enjoy giving interviews that much. And I just really dislike it that when you're dealing with some record labels and people putting out your music, that it's like they want you to do certain things that it just feels like total prostitution, misunderstanding of your brand, of who you are. You know, they're like, oh, you should be more like Mumford and Sons, you know, with what you do, or you should do these shout outs, you know, like this is always a thing of like, oh, you're playing in Hamburg, why don't you make a video saying Hamburg, you know, we're gonna come and fucking destroy you and stuff. And it's like, that's not me, that's not like that doesn't fit my music at all. And now it's like, like you said, it's like, oh yeah, you should, if you want to make money with your music, then you should really like put more stuff into your social media and everything. I'm like, where's the art in that?
You know? Yeah, it's true. And it's kind of like, it comes back to this, the balance between trying to do something. To me, this is not really, you know, obviously it's creative on some level, but it's separate from making music or something like this. So I can make the distinction in my head, but I have friends in bands and they're like, they're doing exactly what you're talking about, or they're going on these sites where people pay for them to shout out, hey, happy birthday, and this kind of stuff. And I said to a friend of mine who's in a death metal band who shall remain nameless, and he was complaining to me that nobody took his band seriously. And I was like, dude, you're doing birthday party shout outs. That's
I love Max Cavalera, but what he was doing and it felt painful to see people thinking about somebody so great. I know he's got to pay the bills and all. So, and I don't sort of begrudge him that, but it just feels wrong. It's like, you know, you're Ozzy Osbourne, you know, to me, and you shouldn't be there online doing shout outs for people. It's embarrassing.
Yeah. I suppose.
No disrespect.
No, ultimately, I suppose that we should lay the blame for this probably at the door of the CEO of Spotify or something, as opposed to particularly blaming Max Cavalera. But I subscribe to the same opinion though. It's something very undignified about it, you know? And I question myself with some of the same things. Like I did a YouTube, I have a YouTube channel and I put my podcast up there and I do the odd video, but sometimes I sit there and I go, okay, somebody said to me, hey, can we have your top 5 vintage shirts? No, I'm a heavy metal nerd. I love talking about shirts. If you were sitting here, I'd go, fuck, have you seen this Bauhaus shirt from 84 or whatever? I mean, a few drinks and I'm bang into super nerd stuff. But I thought, kind of stuff. Like, so on that sense, it's not, I don't feel too compromised, but at the same sense, I mean, what am I really trying to do? Just move the dial of a couple of numbers and sort of, I feel quite conflicted about it. I mean, I have a Patreon now, and I made it 5 years ago and then left it closed because I just felt awkward about it. And then this sort of just shoved it into the light, and as they're going, and it's actually not as, it's not bad. Actually, it's just a kind of, it's like a sort of a weird fan club. But then I thought to myself, this is, I sort of said to myself, well, you know, poets in the 18th century had patrons. And I thought to myself, you pretentious cunt. Yeah. You know? I don't know how to think about it, you know?
I guess it's what you, whatever you do with it. I mean, if you're providing something that's, you know, of value and excitement to your fans, the people who understand what you do, then I think it's important. And the people who don't understand what you do are always going to find something wrong with what you do. So that's not true. Important. It's more like the sort of self-value for me is about sort of what I would enjoy out of it. And I don't enjoy doing shout out videos, but I can definitely understand the Patreon thing because you're directly interfacing with your fans. You're getting rid of the middleman, the management, the label, everything else. So that's a beautiful thing I think about the modern age is that you have this possibility. I mean, you know, I'm not as experienced as you in the scene, but I do know the days of tape trading and everything, and I started there, and so it's kind of an amazing thing that you've got this just very fast track letter network where you're able to contact everyone without taking time to wait for the post and everything. But same kind of system. And I know that I know what you mean about that it works for some people though. Like it feels like for Nurgle, for example, to be very like present and open, it really works for his brand and his image. He carries it so well, he can get away with it. I would never try to be like that on social media because it would just be a laughing stock. But that sort of just works into his brand of who he is as a person. Yeah. It doesn't feel like it's forced. Like he's genuinely enjoying showing everybody what he's up to. But
yeah, I mean, he's a rock star. That's the difference.
He's a rock star. I mean, he can get away with it. Yeah, he's there. But I like the mysticism of, you know, like the old stories of, oh, I went to this guy's place from this band, and you know, we had this night where he showed me his old shirts and some of his collection, and those are things which are sort of coveted. You know, they're important mysteries somehow, and I don't really want to like
make everything give that public.
Yeah. I don't want to give it away. I have a really nice summer house with some sort of important pictures and things there, and I could go there and show that, and that would probably delight Hex Vessel fans that, oh, look at where we spend our time in the woods and everything. But it's like it's my play, you know. I, as a video director that I know, and he makes great videos here in Finland for bigger bands like Battle Beast and stuff like that. He has this amazing place in the countryside, and I was like, have you shown many videos here? And he looked at me and he was like, no, this is my, you know, this is my home. I'm not going to like shoot a video here. I don't want people to see my magical home. It's like that's your spiritual place. You don't really want to give that away. How much money is that worth?
It's a very good point. Yeah. I mean, I feel odd even the concept of sitting in this space, which is kind of, you know, the front bit of where I live, and you're kind of like, okay, hence why the backdrop is covering most of the back of it. Because so part of me is like, I don't want people to just exactly see every part of where you live. But then you're being asked, I guess, to externalize or make public. And that's the sort of vulgarity of it. In a sense, you're being asked to try and somehow monetize things which should be personal, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, and then it's also like you said, it's like if you're a rock star, I mean, you're more there than I am. You're very successful at what you do, so I guess there's a certain level of expectation also from the fan base that they kind of want more from you. And then I guess it's okay, depending on what you feel is right to kind of give them and what works as well, you know. It's I think if I'm sitting there trying too hard to show everything, it just feels like a strip show, you know. It's just like there's nothing there for people to enjoy if there's no art there, you know.
Well, you played the, you did a Hex Vessel stream though, and you were talking a bit about it afterwards, but how did you feel doing that? Or how did it, how was the process?
We really enjoyed it. It was really bizarre, but we were out in the woods and we chose a bit of woodland next to where our favorite sauna is. And it's at this lake, and you can sit there outside the sauna and you look over the lake and you see the whole of Tampa. It's a really beautiful place. It's kind of one of those places where you go there and you fall back in love with the city again, and you know why you live there, and it's really romantic setting. And you can swim in the lake and everything, and even in the winter you can swim in there. So we chose this place. It's really pretty, and we went there, and it's kind of isolated. You got to drive there, so it's not right in the center. And in the middle of nowhere, we're just about to start the live stream, and this massive band of Chinese tourists just like came into the woods with a stereo, and they wanted to sit down and like listen to the music right where we were. And we were like, "Well, you can't be here. Like, we're going to play music and everything." And they were like, "Oh, sorry, we just arrived. We're like tourists. We're just looking around." And I was like, "It's supposed to be a lockdown. Like, what are you doing here? Like, how did you get here? We thought all the flights from China are cancelled, you know?"
Yeah.
So it's just really bizarre. And we were about to do this kind of like, you know, kind of meaningful folk music in a beautiful setting. And actually we were totally disturbed. It could have ended in disaster. It would have been hilarious to have them walking through the shop. But,
Of course it's a live stream as well. Yeah. There's some sort of deep metaphor at work there, isn't there, really?
And I mean, being Finland, you cannot escape groups of young guys with bags of beer stalking into the forest to drink their beer. So there was a lot of that going on as well. And I was just like, as we're playing, I kind of could see these guys coming through the forest, and you can hear them a little bit further away, like crashing through the trees. And I'm like, please don't come through it, because you can see the meme, you know, like,
yeah.
I can see it happening. Hex Vessel's forest stream is like ruined by these drunk guys. It's going to be on Blabbermouth or something, just for people to laugh about.
Yeah,
I don't know. Our band doesn't get on Blabbermouth, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And that's everybody's, yeah, it, that's really, people are searching for that meme moment all the time, you know. I mean, I've been very conscious of, even when I've been doing the podcast, really. I didn't do it to be about politics or anything like this. It's got the odd political part here and there, but you're very conscious about what you're saying. And I go back and listen before. I don't just go bleh and just post it out there. And then you go, is there anything here that could be taken out of context to make that meme, that bleh, that moment, you know? That was probably just it right there that I just did.
I mean, I really hate it, and I don't think humor has improved. You know, I'm going to sound like a really humorless person to say this, but I really don't think the humor of the world has improved because of memes and that whole culture. But I really detest that. You know, everything's about trying to find some funny moment in something serious. You know, and going back to primordial and what you give, I think it's I think that it's really okay to be passionate and to yeah. have feelings about things. And I mean, especially with doing Hex Vessel, because Beast Milk and Grave Pleasures and stuff, there's a lot of tongue in cheek. But when it comes to Hex Vessel, it's very, it's just really close to the heart music.
Yeah.
And so you get a lot of that, people who just really want to take the piss out of it. And I think it's like, it's very mean because it's low hanging fruit, you know.
Sure.
It's the basest form of humor, is to just like take the piss out of people. And you know that you're Irish, I'm English. That's basically how we live our lives, is
to
piss out of people.
Yeah, you make a very good point, and people will always often will say that to me, you know, and I will say that there is no place for humor in primordial, that it's unrelentingly serious, and it was always meant to be. We're funny guys, we have a great time and a lot of fun together, make each other laugh, but the music is that's what it's meant to be. And there just seemed to be, I agree with you, this constant need and urge to find I suppose it's the fundamental devaluing of art, or the fact that modern society just doesn't really think you should be taking something seriously like that. You know, the kind of thing when you play at a festival and there's, you know, a bunch of people who will go dressed now as like furry animals and this, that and the other, and somebody will want to take a picture with you, and I'll just say, no, you can't. Or I won't do an interview with somebody with a, who does it in a silly voice. There's a myriad of things that I just will refuse to do. I think to myself, was it different in the 70s? I guess it was, but definitely there's an element of modern society which is just, as you say, all about somehow trying to deconstruct everything to just being a memory, I guess.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, maybe it's just a general lack of people feeling spiritual, for want of a better word, about things. I don't, in a way, I don't blame them because there's been so much sort of pressure on that for so long. But it's a difficult thing when you talk about festivals as well. Like, festivals have felt like a joke for a really long time. You know, there's like, I get so pissed off going to watch a band at a big festival like Hellfest and having like big balloons going across the crowd and like people just treating it like it's a joke, you know. And it's like, I can't watch this fucking band, you know, like this is balloon going around. It's like, what do you prefer? You're gonna bounce the fucking balloon around or are you gonna watch the music, you know? Yeah. Or like in Hellfest, there was like Wetaim had this great stage show. People were watching the toilets because the toilets are spouting flames at Hellfest, and people are watching these flames, you know, from the toilets. I'm like, if a festival is more interesting, if the toilets are more interesting at the festival than the band, what has happened to festivals, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and having said that, without the festivals, that will be one of the main arteries of modern rock and metal gone, you know, which we can see, is that it's a really strange situation. I totally agree that it's sort of become part farce, but an essential farce nonetheless, you know? And I can't complain, we've had great gigs every summer, but you know, brilliant gigs at Hellfest, but I do know what you mean. You go around to watch a big band and you go, okay, this is like some sort of cartoon dystopia, and I think I'll just go back.
I mean, it's a great place. It's a great place. I don't mean to put it down. It's just like, I think it's just more of kind of the mindset of that people want to be so entertained, and at the expense sometimes of watching good music that means something. I don't want to go and see Warning playing Hellfest or something, you know, like, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. There's some bands that I just would steer clear of watching in certain venues or certain arenas because it just doesn't work. It's
we were going to talk about this before. I think you were saying that you got to do some guest vocals on a few things and felt a little bit odd at some sort of pop music festival. You can explain that, what we're talking about.
I think it was the Carpenter Brute experience that I did the song with them, and it was a really popular song on their last album, did really well. It's a great track. I was really honoured to do it. So there's no complaints there. It was more like just getting up and doing the song with them. I realized that how unimportant the personality of the singer was, you know, that a lot of people, most people didn't know who the fuck it was. Like, there's this guy getting up to sing. What's this about? I didn't even think about it. I was just enjoying the show a lot. And I guess it's a testament to what they've built, that they don't need any personalities there. Everybody knows who Frank, the main guy, is, but other than that, it really doesn't matter who's playing. But that's kind of, I guess, what's changed about the whole. What did Marty Friedman describe his idea of what Megadeth could have been? It was like the four-man diamond. It's like the four or five-man diamond of a rock band. It just doesn't exist really anymore. I think like people are fed up with that personalities, and they just want to have fun. And so people were dancing to Carpenter Brute, and I was on stage with them singing. But I felt so surreal because I felt kind of silly. Like, I was like, it should just be the playback now, and not me standing here. And you know, you have to do the frontman thing. So you have to kind of try to engage with the crowd who just looking straight through you, and they're reading my words on the screen. I wrote those words, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's not important. That's something to deal with as a frontman. It's really like a kind of a shock because you're used to being the focus. You're used to trying to be the focus you should be. And actually I was just, you know, like the most uninteresting thing there. I was like, okay, this is hard, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never really thought. I've experienced it where I've guested with a few bands, but it's all been metal and rock stuff, and you kind of can still kind of take hold of the situation. But that whole new synth retro wave thing, I mean, I suppose what it is I remember going to see years ago, maybe even years ago, you would have seen Sisters of Mercy. And it always struck me sometimes that a lot of the goths or people who would go, they went there to take drugs and dance to a point. They weren't really that interested. And the things that metalheads look for sometimes, like I can't even see the guitar player. Is he really playing? Or, you know, it's just only fog and stuff. And you realize, oh, this isn't that important to this audience, you know? Now, that's a very small, I can imagine that's a very small, acute observation compared to something like Carpenter Brut. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. And was this just like a pop music festival or like what kind of festival?
No, this was like, I did it at Inferno and Hellfest. And it was maybe Inferno is a bit bad just because it's a, you know, people in Finland know a bit more who I am, but it was a similar thing that, I think, you know, I'm glad to do the guest appearances with them. But playing live isn't really an integral thing. I think it was more just for us, you know, for me and the guys to do it, which is fun, but it was just an experience to realize that for the fans, this is like just a not interesting thing at all. I expected, like, you know, some people to be like, oh, that was a great thing. The actual guy who sang on the song came, but it's like, there's no, you know, nerdism at all. When I was young, it was all about like who played on what record, and you know, you had to learn it all because it wasn't online. So we had to know the names of the guys. You know, we knew all the names of the guys from Cannibal Corpse and Deicide and stuff because you kind of had to. And maybe that's just something that's gone now because you don't. You know, why would you have to? You know, why would you have to know about it? And outside of the music, which is about technical playing, which is another thing altogether, maybe it just doesn't really matter. And we struggled with it with Beast Milk as well, because I guess, you know, the music did so well. We were just trying to play catch up with the kind of playing live and the image wise that a lot of people were like, oh, is this the band? Okay.
Yeah.
I really like the record, but they didn't marry the guys and the stage show with what they were hearing in the music. And I guess that's the sort of thing you have to reach the point at which you're convincing, and sort of Led Zeppelin or bands like that didn't have a problem with that because it totally fit the image of the person on stage was the music, you know. It's like, yeah, the fucking Robert Plant is that look, you know, and how they dressed and everything. So it's I think unless you got that really well thought out from the beginning, we just weren't prepared for like having to kind of catch up with what people were thought the music was, you know. And I'm a bit like that. I think, like I said, I'm not comfortable with the interviews, not such a great front man or live singer. It's never really been my forte or I mean, I enjoy singing.
Well, I think you undersell yourself there, but I think that maybe the thing with Beast Milk was because if you think about your equivalent in 1979 or 1980 or 1981, a band probably would have been out digging the clubs before making the record and honing who they were. I mean, if you eat most of the bands that we think of as iconic, whether it's the fucking Ramones or the, I don't know, the Dead Boys or Richard Hell, I don't know, all that kind of, I'm thinking about that sort of New York scene from the late 70s and all that kind of stuff. It took those bands a while to find the classic look, and mostly they weren't all being documented instantly for years. Now we look back and go, fucking hell, look at Talking Heads with the way they looked in 77 or something like this. But with something like Beast Milk, because I guess that's just the way modern music is, you kind of, it was put together musically to be reminiscent, I think, of some of those bands, but the context was so different that when you kind of show up, yeah, people already have this idea that, oh, they're going to look like Peter Murphy from 1981 or whatever. And so it's a bit hard to live up to that your bass player's a dude with a beard and jeans and t-shirt or whatever's going on, you know?
Yeah, I think they misunderstood kind of where we were coming from because we just didn't have long enough to present ourselves. We went up on that whole Fenridge band of the week ghost thing where everyone was looking for the new ghost, you know. It really felt when Ghost came along that there was going to be a lot of bands like them,
And to Tobias's credit, he had it all planned out from the beginning. You know, he had a whole, you know, series of stages he was going to get to. Whereas we were actively taking it easy. Like I remember there was arguments with the guys. I wanted to take it slowly because I was like, we should play like we should, you know, we should cut our teeth. We should really be a live band before we get called on to play Roadburn. Yeah. And, you know, it was sort of like, lo and behold, we went from tape cassette to Roadburn, you know, like that was sort of unfair on us in a way we got sprung up so quickly, and it sort of died as quickly as it materialized. And so that's always in my mind that it's not a natural thing. It has to be a thing you work on and you grow the live show and to be comfortable with what you do on stage. Mm. But it's a, yeah, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah. And it's, I suppose it's just symptomatic of the way modern society is in that respect, that something can just move so quickly that in the old days, in the 70s or something, would have taken, you know, dozens and dozens, perhaps even hundreds of gigs to get right. And all of a sudden, when, you know, the Ramones get to land in London in 78 and fucking change the world, or 77 or whatever it was, that iconic show where everybody apparently was at, they get there on full steam already. And you go, how many fucking gigs has this band done? Probably 120 already, 100 or more. Since 73, 74.
Yeah.
Whereas now a band will go, fuck, we've got to play live. Who has a leather jacket? I don't know. You know.
Yeah, and I mean, like, how can you afford it? Sometimes, like, oh, fuck, I should have something cool to wear on stage, but I can't afford a new jacket. So
yeah, but but the economy of it is different now, because that idea, I mean, even if I was listening to, I was just listening to Rory Gallagher the other day, and I was looking at the tour dates, and I was kind of daydreaming, going to myself, God, I wonder if that's what we'll have to do next year, just play distance shows in Ireland. Fucking hell. And I was looking at his tour dates, and there was a touring circuit for a person like him playing. Now you would, there's nothing like that in Ireland. You couldn't, I mean, you could probably do it, but for us, one gig every 2-3 years, then you're going, oh, that's that old hard rock way of doing things. We have a variation of that now, but the relentless touring is not quite what it used to be. Although, then again, maybe it, I mean, then I think of Rotting Christ and Vader and Marduk and bands like that and go, well, there's a different story there, you know?
Well, I think for you, you have a rich back catalogue of work that you know, spans a long time. So you've got a few generations of fan bases there already, and that's a lucky situation. I think for bands, I feel for bands that this year was going to be their year. Mm. I can think of a few of those off the top of my head who this year should have been their year, and it's not going to happen. You know, and it's because of the virus, and I'm not sure if they get that chance again. That's a very sad thing, because you know, you know how it is. It's like you have that window of opportunity, and you guys were, you know, signed with Misanthropy and all of those things, and it's sort of like it was a ladder, and this business is snakes and ladders. So it's like if that hadn't happened, you never know how things would have rolled. So I think about that for these bands. It's like, of course, persistence. Everybody tells you, you know, persistence is everything, and work hard and it will happen. But that's not everything. You know, there's a sort of a thing about the being in the here and the now, that sort of, you know, you know that, you know, of bands who make better records out of their buzz period, but people just focus on the buzz album and that's it, you know. It's like,
that moment passes pretty quickly. It's an interesting point. Yeah, I mean, I was being a fucking cranky bitch the other day complaining about this, and somebody was going, oh, but get to write the new Primordial album, blah, blah, blah. And I was there like, look, if the new Primordial album had been made last year and was going to be released this year, I wouldn't release it. And they were like, what do you mean? I said, I just wouldn't release it, because all my life would be this. Zoom chats for 2 weeks. And then, oh, okay, you just go back to the lockdown and back. You know what I mean? Like, there's no agency, no purpose. There's actually, and it sounds really selfish, but there's just nothing in it for me other than to see numbers move and read comments. And I just thought, that's not why I play music. I play music to go, right, we're going to go and fucking, there's release shows, there's, you, there's movement in the world, there's ripples in the pond or whatever you want to call it. And to make an album now this year and release it, if this Primordial was coming out, I think I'd have pushed it back a year and cancelled it, because there just doesn't, you know, I was having an argument with Addy from Solstifer. It's a new Solstifer album coming, and I was complaining to him, forgetting that his album was coming out, and he's like, oh, mine's coming out. I was like, fuck. You know, I was just like, shit, sorry, man, you know. But I think I'd push it back, because I selfishly, there's just nothing in it for me. If that sounds like a dickhead move, I don't know.
No, I totally understand. And I'm trying to I think everybody's sort of situation when it comes to that is so subjective, because,
yeah, this is true.
You know, it's what fulfills you, what drives you, your agency, as you said. I think for me, I would like it if some bands would take this opportunity to kind of like go back to the rehearsal place and really understand what it means to be a band make some records like they used to make back in the day. It would be beautiful if they suddenly decided, like, oh, we don't need to have the hey, hey, hey bit in the song because there's no live show. So maybe we can actually just work on making a good song, you know? And this isn't relevant to what you do at all, but I think that it could be a unique opportunity here for so many artists to just focus on making good music and not to worry about, you do think about live shows when you make albums, and the more you play live, the more you think about it. And so I think that's sometimes been on certain albums that I've been doing, has been a downfall of the record. You know, it's been like a thinking about what songs we have in the set, and thinking, oh, when we make this record, maybe we should add a couple of songs like this because that will change the set. Instead of thinking about this would be just a great record to make. And I've gone back to that now, kind of coming full circle of just making a record. And so the last Hex Festival we did, I thought really just about that, just like, you know, it became more whimsical in the right way of just whatever creative impulses come in that are good. These are the ones that will make the record, the ones that kind of want it to be there, rather than thinking, okay, we're going to have a year of live shows. Maybe we should have a few faster numbers because, you know, it's damn boring playing all these slow songs. It shouldn't really come into it, but it does.
That's interesting. I guess the difference maybe between Hex Vessel and Grave Pleasures or something is that, you know, one is sort of, again, it's the rock and roll thing. One has got some sort of rock and roll elements to consider for the live setting. And I suppose when writing a Grave Pleasures album, you'd have to consider, you know, I know with Primordial, which is probably somewhere in between, it's still got that sort of gloom to it, but it's got a little bit of rock and roll as well, or whatever you want to say. Or I think to myself, oh, this could be a big chorus or whatever. But if something is completely removed from that, maybe that's more what Hex Vessel represents then. I don't know, you know. I mean, you'd probably consider that when you're writing Grave Pleasure songs, that, oh, this is going to be a banger live or whatever, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I try to think about it being a banger, kind of in every sense. So those records for me that represent sort of the best of rock and roll, and like a classic album like Appetite for Destruction or Queens of the Stone Age, Songs for the Deaf, that it's like, just, you know, you know it's going to be great live and also on the stereo and in the car and in those different situations, like with friends at a party or that kind of thing. So on
it
all levels,
and
that should be the way of thinking maybe. But it's very difficult to take the live thing out of your mind. And it's you're in a rehearsal place when you're playing together. This will be great live, you know. Yeah. And someone's going to say it at some point. That's going to work great live. Or maybe we should repeat that refrain so that gives crowds a chance to sing along with it. You kind of know how it's going to be digested. If that comes out of the mix, I don't know. Is it a good or a bad thing? Because who knows, really? It's maybe it's best not to think about this stuff really at all.
Maybe that's true. How many awful death rock, neo folk, black country sort of, like, you know, sub awful Woven Hand records are we going to get from metal musicians now in the next year.
Oh my God, yeah. And I mean, already like this guy, well, I'm not going to start going into the names, but there's so many people who have like a billion side projects already. And it's like, I think then about the Nick Cave speech that like, maybe they should read Nick Cave a bit more, you know, like take a break, guys, you know, like step back a little bit more. Maybe the world doesn't need more of your music, but it's very easy to say because I indulge myself, and so everybody should indulge themselves creatively on whatever it is they want to do, you know.
They should, but at the same time, like I was having this argument with a friend of mine who was saying, oh, this is a great time for the underground, and I was there going, well, you know, the underground was really, what was it really? Trading tapes and writing letters, but we all had aspirations to something else. And we all wanted to be in other countries and go on tour. And we saw the dates for tours in 92. If the underground, I was being a dickhead, but if the underground was writing letters and trade tapes, then we're here. We're back in it now, which is just sending emails and trading files. Yeah. There, you're back in the underground. Yeah. Good for you. But at the same time, which of course it sucks, but at the same time, a lot of people said to me, oh, it's a good time to get creative. And I went, well, was this broken? Are we fixing, you know what I mean? I was just being, again, being an asshole. And I was just going like, well, we're fixing something that wasn't broken. Are we just going to get loads of more average records, which we don't need? I don't know. Or that's a really middle-aged way of looking at it, isn't it?
But I mean, I think about it in terms of the time that I have now is very limited. So I want to listen to, classic records and stuff from my collection, which I know I'm going to really enjoy, and is going to sound really, really great because I've got, you know, this window of an hour here. I'm going to sit and listen to some really good music. Mm. I changed my listening habits based on the amount of time that I would have to put into it. So I just wonder how that will go for people with a lot more time, you know. Now they have a lot more time to digest music, to listen to it, enjoy it. If you were a music fan before, you were indulging it on the side, you had a 9-to-5. Now maybe you have a lot more time at home to put on music, you know, in the office, that kind of thing. It could change listening habits, and now we've got the tools to kind of open it up. Like I was always like blown away by the fact that all these young kids in Helsinki, when we lived there, were sort of so tuned on to all this proto punk and like stuff that took, you know, years to dig down the bottom to get. And then, you know, you'd reach some old dude who would recommend, you know, like you put on your Instagram, Sir Lord Baltimore, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff like that was just like word of mouth treasures from someone, you know. You got to check out High Tide. That was like heavy, way ahead of its time. And these kids knew it all, and they had, you know, they had, because they had access to it. So it's like, it possibly could result in in something positive.
That's an interesting point. It wouldn't be the first time I've gone to somebody's, to like I say, a party. It's actually, this has specifically happened to me in Finland, where I went to a party, like a pre going out to some gig party. I was visiting and annoying some people. And I was looking through the girls who owned the apartment, their records. And it just struck me like, every record here is fucking cool. There's no Benediction record. There's no Gorefest records. There's no like kind of C Division death metal from 94. There's no missteps. There's no, everything was cool. And then I was slagging them, and I was there going, where's the first Deicide? I see you have Sadistic Intent records. There's no Deicide. And as you're just, they're just like, huh? Who the fuck listens to Deicide? I was like, yeah, okay. You know, or Immolation. Then you realize, oh, it's the aesthetic and the artwork. But it's really struck me that everything, it was like it was just curated by somebody who like, okay, here you go, Death SS, Blue Cheer. Everything was perfect. And I thought that was really, it probably ties in with what you were saying. It was really funny and interesting that, there was no missteps, you know? At least none I can
see. It reminds me of the Redburn Zender guys talking about going to England, playing with Impaled Nazarene back
in the... I was there.
Were you playing at that gig?
I know. I actually was in the house where they were staying. I went to visit, and then Misanthropy organized the part of Fibwin Zender's trip there. I just happened to be staying in the same place, so that's how we all hung out. We got naked. everything you wrote.
I should have known that you probably were there. But they were just talking about that, like, you know, whereas in Norway they had been building this sort of impeccable scene of appreciation of all the right bands. Mm. They went to the UK and met the fans who just had like sort of a totally different understanding of extreme metal, and a lot of bands that they were just like, who listens to this? And we were kind of, they were really disappointed. But I think it's like back then you had one or two scene makers, taste makers, and you were just lucky if you had someone. I mean, you know, they had Euronymous and everybody else who was obviously spreading the good work. But I remember when I was a kid growing up in London, you really had no access. Like there was no scene at all. So you really had to fight to get hold of good records. And you know, you'd get we were talking about this with a friend the other day, that you would get kind of like a mediocre record, but you would end up loving that record because you had to, you had to listen to it.
You'd spend 10 quid on it.
Nothing else. I have to like this. I'm not going to take it back because, you know, it's all they had at the shop, you know. And so you end up liking a lot of stuff. And I have all these guilty pleasure records that I know that I could never play to my mates who are into metal because they were there for me through hard times, but they're embarrassing. You know, it's like, it's not good music. I don't look back on it and think, oh, that's, you know, great album. I just think it's terrible music, but I still value it personally. You know, these are like sort of embarrassing treasures of my own.
This is where you should be looking at being a content creator. You should be doing Matt's five embarrassing YouTube five records. But yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. I remember being in the record shop in Dublin in 91 and had a Mental Funeral in one hand and Blessed Are the Sick in the other, and only having the money for one. And I'd saved up for like 2 weeks to have that $8.99 to buy one or the other, and you're going, and that was like the choice that month, just that month.
Yeah,
and there was probably Malevolent Creation and whatever else, but that was the choice that month. Then you made your choice, and now I open the Holix digital account and I just go, oh my god, there's like 450 or 475 new records in the last 2 weeks, and I just, what can you do? You know, spend more time listening to like Goat Worshipper from Peru or something. I don't know, you know.
I really like labels like Oral Hypnox in the north of Finland. They do kind of, you sign up and you get a letter in the post, and it's all physical products, nothing on Spotify and everything, and it's the kind of music that works like that, because it's ritual music, and it's this, you know, a lot of ambient music. But I think it increases your appreciation of the music and makes you think of it as more, you know, magical music, because it's harder to obtain. And I think that's a sort of area where bands could find a niche and could excel. Is just like, you know, how can you be different? How can you make this more of an important experience, instead of, you know, releasing 10 t-shirts and putting all these video clips out there? Maybe think about making your music a little bit more harder to obtain, or more esoteric in a way. You know, like there's all these black metal bands out there that claim to be occult, but there's nothing occult about it. It's just straight in your face. You know, it's a commercial enterprise. And it's shit. You know, it's just rubbish music. It hasn't evolved since the 90s. It's not interesting. So it would be great if there was more of that kind of, if we're going back to the tape trading days, then why don't we just do it? You know?
Yeah. I suppose the problem is that most people are considering elements of what you would just said, and then figuring out, okay, so how can I externalize that? How can I make that into the Instagram post? Because everything is about trying to take the most personal things and reveal them to everyone. And so when you're talking about something which is just a letter writing enterprise, even that, I suppose, would become co-opted by a certain element of kind of, you know, cool is the new uncool is the new cool kind of thing. I don't know. I guess that there are just so many choppy seas to navigate, and you have to make some concessions to one and then make a decision on, well, no, we don't do that other thing in the other case, you know?
Yeah, I think one industry businessman, a very nice guy, said to me, high up in a big label, he said, these days, what you have to do is make really, really good music, and that is it. You know, you cannot rely on anything else, really. You know, and so it's a brutal truth to have to face, is that the gimmick alone isn't enough. You know, yeah. So that, like, we go back to Ghost, if you were stupid, you'd say, it's just all image. You know, it's just a fucking gimmick. But it isn't. I don't listen to it. But he's a very, very clever songwriter, you know, and he's very clever at knowing kind of what works. So,
no doubt.
His credit, he's really thought it all through, and I admire that. I admire that if you're going to bring the gimmick into what you do, there has to be, you have to make good music. And I'm much more for sort of like the early Metallica kind of just a bunch of guys playing really meaningful music, but it's one in a million, you know. Now it's kind of been done, so you have to think everything through. But if you don't have good music, it's kind of like game over, basically.
Yeah, well, sir, it's been over an hour. It's usually what I do, and I think game over is a good two words to end on.
It's time to end it.
But
this was great.
Yeah, it's been a total pleasure. It should go up soon enough, and total pleasure to talk to you, sir. Let's hope it's not game over, but you know.
Yeah, hope not. Hope I get to see you in Dublin or elsewhere sometime soon.
We shall see. All right, sir.
Cheers.
Be good. Care. Thanking you.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.